David Demers. David?
It's so great to be here tonight and see all the energy around here and see how we're going to learn a lot about just the potential that mushrooms have. So, from airborne yeasts producing meat and wine, the use of medicinal mushrooms by prehistoric peoples is potent medicine. Mushrooms and other fungi have played a pivotal role in human history and development for millennia. And in the case of Paul Stanley, since founding Fungi Perfecti in 1980, he has written a number of inspirational books on the vast potential of mushrooms, including his latest book, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. Tonight, Paul will be discussing the many ways mushrooms can help improve the health of the environment and even our own bodies, as well as his current research at the U.S. government's BioShield and BioDefense program. So now I give you, as recognized as one of the 50 visionaries of 2008 by Dr. Rinker, the mycologist Paul Stamets.
Thank you, David, and thanks to all of you. I'm truly honored to be here. It is great to see so many young people in the audience. Where many of us collectively, we represent the body, intellect, of knowledge that's been passed down over thousands of years. And I stand before you tonight as one of those people who benefited from the knowledge of our ancestors. And I want to particularly thank Dr. Alexander Smith and Dr. Daniel Stuntz. I met them when I was 17, 18 years of age, and they mentored me. They took me under their wing. I was a very shy, long-haired hippie with a strong stuttering habit. I still have that a little bit. And they saw an interest that I took in fungi as being so sincere that they benefited me with much of their time. So they have now passed on. But I think we all, you know, truly stand on the shoulders of our ancestors. And in that regard, some of you may be wondering, what's the deal with this hat? So let me tell you about my hat, which I very much like, by the way. This hat is actually made from this mushroom, which you have growing on the birch trees here. This is called amadou. The Latin name is Fomes fomentarius. It's a wood conch, and it grows, you know, sometimes 2 to 3 years on birch trees. And this mushroom is why many of us are here today. There is no doubt that several hundred thousand years ago, we migrated from Africa. We are truly Africans at heart. And when we moved northward into Europe, we discovered something new called winter boots. And this mushroom allowed for the portability of fire. It's called the tinder conch. You can burrow this mushroom out, put embers of fire inside, and carry fire for days. And so the fire keeper of the clan, by using this mushroom, could keep fire alive and keep the clan warm during the winter months. And if the fire keeper failed, or the amadou was not present, and you didn't have fire, then the clan would likely perish. How little do we know now of that which our ancestors took for granted or knew about the use of these mushrooms, as important as they are for survival? Now, when you boil this mushroom in water, it has very strong antibacterial properties and begins to sort of delaminate into mycelium. And the mycelium is this fibrous web-like structure. You'll see lots of it. And it is extremely flammable. So amadou also revolutionized warfare, because although the Chinese invented gunpowder, the Europeans invented the rifle, because of amadou allowed the flint spark to ignite the amadou that ignited the gunpowder. So this mushroom has been extremely important in the evolution of human culture. And so in a similar fashion, I present to you a friend of mine. And this is agaricon. Agaricon is from the old growth forest of the Pacific Northwest. It is now thought to be largely extinct in Europe. It is present in British Columbia, Washington State, Oregon, and Northern California. And I suggest, and we'll make the case to you tonight, that agaricon holds as much promise as amadou has had in our ancestral history for helping us to navigate into the future. And I believe the way for us to follow is the path of mycelium. I want to present to you a series of mycological solutions, and there is perhaps no better audience that I've ever brought this message to than you today. You, as you will see, and reading the May 2009 NOFA newsletter, I was just ecstatic. There was articles on bird flu, articles on pollution, factory farms, diseases, collapses of the ecosystem. Yahoo! That's exactly my subject matter. So I want to show you some very practical methods that I've discovered in the course of my many years in the field of mycology. Much of this knowledge has come from nature. I believe nature speaks. I believe in natural intelligence. Nature is intelligent. We just need to listen to nature and learn the lessons of evolution. So the mushroom's mycelium is oftentimes this white fibrous substance, and then under certain conditions is triggered into mushroom formation. Now there's 1 to 2 million species of fungi in the kingdom. There's approximately 10% of those are mushroom-forming fungi, about 150,000 species. But we've only been able to identify 14,000 species to date, which means 90% of the 150,000 species of mushrooms that are resident in nature, we have not yet been able to classify. How much do we not know? Under certain conditions, typically a drop in temperature, an influx of water, giving sufficient nutrition, and as the mycelium wicks to the surface, it exhales carbon dioxide, inhales oxygen, and most species of mushrooms are photosensitive. They have no chlorophyll, but they respond and react to light. So I oftentimes have a huge hurdle, because when I present, a talk about mushrooms, how is this going to be relevant? And I follow this path through life because of my passion for many different types of mushrooms, including the so-called magic mushrooms. And I followed my heart and my spirit. And by doing so, things have happened. And I want to describe some of those events in the course of this talk. So this is a classic portobello-like mushroom that actually is a species I co-authored that is called Agaricus brasiliensis, also known as blazii. But it's a classic, cap and stem mushroom, and they have gills underneath and spores form. The mycelial mats of some mushroom species can be resident within the ecosystem for decades, even hundreds of years before a mushroom forms. Many mushrooms that you're familiar with, like oyster mushrooms and turkey tail and chanterelles, they come up annually. A lot of species do not. They are very infrequently seen. And so the mushrooms come up, they sporulate, they release their spores, and they quickly rot. But up until the point of sporulation, the mushrooms have a very strong immune system. Now, it is now known that all plants are part fungi. And so we know about the saprophytic fungi that grow on logs. We know about the parasitic fungi that can kill trees. The mycorrhizal fungi, most of you are pretty familiar with, I imagine, by now. But then there's a group of endophytic fungi that runs parallel to the stem cells and the leaves of virtually all plants. In fact, April 15, 2005, in Science News, there was an article entitled Plants Are All Part Fungi. And so when they did DNA analysis, they discovered that in amplifying the plant DNA, they always found fungal DNA. And so there's a consortium of fungi that are in the ecosystem supporting plant growth. In the mid-1990s, a group of researchers went to Yellowstone Hot Springs, and they walked around Old Faithful. And many of you, how many people have been to Old Faithful in Yellowstone? You walk on the boardwalks, incredibly hot water, and there's grasses growing in the hot water. How is that possible, is what they asked. The groundwater was 160 degrees Fahrenheit, and grasses were thriving. When they pulled the grass out, and they took it back to the laboratory, and they cultured it, they got the plant cells of the grass, but they also thought of fungus. They thought the fungus was a contaminant. Oftentimes, when you tissue culture things in vitro, you find some of the organism. You separate it away from the organism that you intended to grow. So they discarded this contaminant. They grew up the grasses. All the grasses died around 106, 107 degrees. Now, fortunately, there was a mycologist in that laboratory, and she noticed that, that fungus that you discarded may not have been a contaminant, but an ally. And sure enough, when that fungus, which is called Curvularia, and you all, if you have notebooks, please write this down, C-U-R-V-U-L-A-R-I-A. Curvularia is an endophytic fungus. When they joined the Curvularia back with the grass cells and grew them up, the grasses all survived to 160 degrees Fahrenheit. It conferred thermotolerance. Now, as it turns out, Curvularia is a mutualistic fungus, not mycorrhiza, but it's a form of mutualism. It could grow separately from the grasses. When joined with grasses, corn, all the cereal grains, it converts heat tolerance. So the potential of this for fighting desertification, for growing crops with, under drought-like conditions, or being able to otherwise be able to sustain adverse circumstances is greatly enhanced. Now, so this is the tip of the proverbial mycological iceberg, because once it was understood that Curvularia and its endophytic fungi work with the mycorrhizal fungi and work with the saprophytic fungi in forming a fungal guild. These fungal guilds potentiate ecosystem survival in a way heretofore not understood. So my wife and I, we spend a lot of time in the old growth forest, and this is where I like to say we go to church on Sundays. And this is actually very hard to photograph in the old growth forest, so this is an exceptionally good image from my point of view. But I like the idea of the thread of walking through the old growth forest. There's a thread of human impact. Minimal, but not invasive, suggested that the fact that we are part of nature, not a part of nature. And so a group of researchers in Arnold Brandt, 1993, Samard, 1997, primarily get the credit for this discovery, but it was noticed in dark depths of the old growth forest. This is a long exposure. This is about a quarter of a second exposure here with a 400 ASA film. But they noticed that these hemlock trees, they were in the depths of the forest, but there was insufficient amount of light, anything, for these plants to photosynthesize in the lower canopy. When they took the hemlock trees back into a greenhouse, gave the same amount of light, all the hemlock trees died. So thankfully, because it was soon realized that these fungal networks take a long-term view, mothering the ecosystem over multiple generations, allocating and budgeting nutrients, benefiting the plurality of the biodiversity of the ecosystem. So what is mycelium? The mycelium can be incredibly tenacious, it's oftentimes root-like. This is called a rhizomorph root form. And in my calculations, this rhizomorph held more than 30,000 times its mass. And so as mycelium grips through a habitat that holds the habitat together, it is tenacious, it prevents erosion. And an excellent book talking about the mycorrhizal fungi is Smith and Reeves book, and this is a small pine tree, but this extensive zone here is the mycelium of a mycorrhizal fungus that is benefiting the pine tree and vice versa. Mycorrhizal fungi do not break down cellulose. They actually get their sugars from the plant, but they up-channel minerals and other nutrients to the benefit of the plants, so it's a truly a symbiotic relationship. So the present, the use of mycorrhizal fungi, it's a photograph by Mike Amaranthus, a maple tree planted on the same day without mycorrhizal fungi, with mycorrhizal fungi. These things have been proved over and over again, and in my workshop tomorrow, I'll be talking about this a lot more extensively. But here is something that most of you have not seen, probably. This is the first underwater guild mushroom ever found. Now, I asked over the years, do many mushrooms grow underwater? And of course, the answer is no. But there was a researcher by the name of Robert Coffin 4 years ago in the Rogue River, Southern Oregon. He's a hydrologist. He walked up the river knee deep. He looked down. He couldn't believe what he saw. He saw mushrooms fruiting underwater. And so he picks up these mushrooms. He went back to the university. He called a mycologist. He said, no, mushrooms don't go underwater. It must have fallen in the water. It must have been a stick. The mushrooms attacked and fell into the water, et cetera, et cetera. He was actually, pretty dissuaded from this idea. He goes back to the same region the next year. He finds dozens more. Goes back the third year. He finds hundreds more. So he comes back and he took other mycologists up there. And sure enough, they witnessed what he saw. So this is a new species called Saprella aquatica. Gnome probe. I have to say gnome probe because that has not been published in Latin in scientific literature, so we're reserving that name. But Robert Copeland, Darlene Southworth, and Jonathan Frank have discovered the first underwater gilled mushroom. Now, what is this mushroom doing for the ecosystem? The really cool thing about this is that spores form inside the bubbles. The bubbles go downstream and pop.
Wow.
And so spores are released in that fashion. So how little do we know about the role of these fungi within the ecosystem? Fortunately, they sent me some gill fragments. This is what I spend a lot of my time. I do a lot of tissue culture work. We have a laboratory complex that produces over 10,000 kilos of mycelium per week. We've been certified organic for over 25 years. And my mission is to use as many resources that I can muster to save as many rare species of fungi as possible in my lifetime. And in the course of that, we've accumulated several hundred strains of extremely rare fungi. So here's oyster mushrooms growing on straw, day 21, day 23, day 25. 20 to 30% of the cellulose of straw can be converted into dried mushrooms. So these mushrooms are extremely efficient converting plant fiber, lignin and cellulose, into protein-rich, vitamin-rich mushrooms. But the mushrooms don't rot up until the point of after sporulation. And so they're sporulating heavily here, but they're resistant. They have a very strong immune system. I'm going to take off my hat here because it's really, really warm. And so the mushrooms sporulate, and I'm fascinated and focused on how mushrooms rot and the sequence of organisms that grow upon rotting mushrooms. Because of the antibacterial properties of fungi in general, mushrooms pre-select the bacterial communities that become resident upon them. And I believe these bacterial communities are essential for the health of the ecosystem microbially that gives rise to the growth of healthy plants. So here is a Russula mushroom. It's in the old growth forest in a meadow. It's past its prime. It's rotting. Come back a few days later. Its spores are germinating. Other organisms are growing on this as well. And you come back about a week later, and the mushroom melts into this mycelial mat. And the mycelium then goes subterranean. In a single cubic inch of soil, there can be more than 8 miles of these fine threads. In every landmass of Earth is permeated with mosaics of intersecting, interconnecting mycelial mats that are moving cyclically beneath us. Underneath my foot is what I calculated to be more than 300 miles of mycelium. That's how pervasive they are. Fungi are the grand molecular disassemblers in nature. They're soil magicians. They generate soils. They're the interface organisms between life and death. And in building the soil banks and utilizing these fungal mycelial mats, I think we can go a long way to fortify sustainability. So I spent many years as a scanning electron microscopist. I'm going to show you a few of my electron micrographs. This is what the fabric of cells looks like, basically visible with a hand lens. And then looking at it closer under the SCM, you can see it's extremely well designed. So it is a microfiltration membrane. So the flow of nutrients, it gets trapped into this filtration cellular fabric. And the mycelium externally digests its nutrients. We internally digest ours. But 650 million years ago, we shared a common ancestry with fungi. We are more closely related to fungi than we are to any other organism. We exhale carbon dioxide, so do fungi. We inhale oxygen, so do fungi. Our best antibiotics against bacteria come from fungi, but we have very few good antibiotics against fungi because of our closer ancestry to fungi. So the antifungal antibiotics tend to be very toxic to us. In fact, there's a new super kingdom that was published in the Journal of Eukaryotic Microbiology 2 years ago called Opisthokonta. And Opisthokonta joins Animalia and fungi into one common group. And so as you look at this, and they see these are incredibly hydrophilic, and so they swell in their membranes, through their membranes with water, but they also capture water in these little bladders. And so myceliate habitats are spongy, they hold water, they keep water resident within the soil, and then as as it dries out, when there's no rain, then these little bladders, the little wells, release their water, but then they become high humidity pockets. And because of the pre-suited activity of the antibiotical properties coming from certain mushroom species and every fungal mat, it sets the stage for the descendant microbial communities that are so critical for the plants that eventually flourish upon the soil base that these fungi have generated. So, I proposed in the early 1990s that mycelium is Earth's natural internet. And I received a lot of flack from my fellow mycologists, some of whom accused me of eating too many magic mushrooms, which was true. I was eating a lot of magic mushrooms in those days. But in talking to internet engineers now, and I'm thankful, in Australia 3 years ago, there were several workshops at the International Mycological Congress. Over about 2,000 mycologists were in residence. And in looking at the mathematical organization of transport systems, research scientists were approached by transportation engineers and as well as computer mathematicians setting up computer internets. And what they discovered when they optimized the organization of the mycelial connections, and these, for every branch or every length going this way, there's a branch, so they're extremely well articulated. They're in computer lingo, they're called hop points, or nodes of crossing, with the idea that if you break one junction here, there's an alternative pathway for sending nutrients or information. So I feel, frankly, greatly vindicated, because now there's several articles that have come out, and the optimization of computer internet systems, where they map what the optimization curves should be an idealized form or structure, it exactly overmapped that the mycelium had already achieved. So I think I was onto something early on. So the mycelium, it produces extracellular metabolites, acids, enzymes. They move enormous amounts of water. Some of you may have had, unfortunately, the house wrecker fungus underneath your house, Serpulo lacrimens. It can move water hundreds of feet. You know, if you can have a drippy pipe somewhere, and it can transport water over hundreds of feet and rot the bottom of your house. But the mycelium hydrates habitats in advance of contact, moistens the wood, and then digests it. And so these cellular droplets, if there's a live motion, these would be dripping down every minute or two. And so here is the mycelium growing over a period of about 45 minutes. These are photomicrographic movies by Patrick Hickey, a friend of mine. So first there's territorial conquest, and there's cross-hatching. So first the mycelium conquests a large area, and then it consolidates its control. This next series of microscopic movies Patrick created about 5 months ago. They've never been shown in public until about 2 months ago. And what he's discovered is absolutely mind-boggling. Because the photomicroscopy that has been done here today has mostly been still microscopy, taking a still image where you have to kill the cells. Or now, with this photomicroscopy method, using fluorescent proteins that you're seeing here, we're being able to see the movement of cellular matter. But what he has discovered, and I want to honor him with this invention, and we've become fast friends, is he's discovered something never before known. These are bundles of comet nuclei, hundreds of nuclei streaming across the mycelial mats. These mycelial mats can have trillions upon trillions of end branches, and at the very tips of these branches, they're multi-nuclear rich, which means lots of genetic material. But notice, the nuclei don't all go in one direction. So comet nuclei stream to the ends and the tips of the mycelium, and there's a back channeling of information. We suspect and hypothesize that what happens with the trillions of end branches of the mycelial mats that are going over landscapes, there's a resort assortment and combination of genetic material. If that genetic recombination is successful by overcoming an adversary, whether it's a chemical barrier, an environmental barrier or whatever, in that successful recombination, then back channels the information to the rest of the mycelial mat, thus educating it. And so then if the mycelial mat is successful at those little tips, what does it do? It grows. And it grows and it forks. And so this is why these mycelial mats are so interesting, they're so resilient, and I believe they're inherently intelligent. And so this is the diagram of the OPTA project, which is a diagram of the computer internet. It shares the mycelial form. The mycelium harbors upon it bacteria. This is a bacillus rods that you see here. It's a very common soil bacterium. And many of these bacteria also produce what's called nanowires. These actually extend these little filaments, and they create also their own matrix of interconnected cells that rest upon the mantle of the mycelium. So there's an interspecies communication going on at the microbial level. on orders of magnitude of complexity that we barely can even imagine. And I believe as we study these natural systems further, we are going to enter into a new sphere of knowledge, which will be dramatically important for us to understand how to live within ecosystems, for terraforming other planets, for moving into the future. So I'm an amateur astronomer. I'll take the advantage of espousing a little bit of my own personal philosophy here. Many of you know that dark matter accounts for the reason why the universe is expanding, not contracting. 95-97% of the matter of the universe cannot be seen. This is from National Geographic. These are galaxies. 170,000 galaxies are in this view, and they're all interconnected by dark matter that also conforms to the mycelial archetype. I believe matter begets life. Life becomes single cells. Single cells become strings. Strings become chains. Chains become networks. Networks become membranes. And this is just the way. This is the way of the universe. And we're likely to find other forms of life elsewhere on other planets that also conform to the same mycelial archetype through natural selection, because this is a smart way of evolving. So let's go back in time. 1.3 billion years ago, the first organisms to come to land were fungi. Plants followed several hundred million years later. Fungi came out of the oceans, hit the shore, and they were able to go on the land because of the unique production of acids, especially oxalic acid. Here's a mycelial mat, and these are oxalic acid crystals that have been combined with calcium. So they're called calcium oxalates. Mycelium encroaches upon land, and with these acids pulls out minerals, iron, manganese, calcium, and in doing so, pockmarks the rock. And as the rock is pockmarked, what happens? It catches water. And so the fungi then are able to penetrate and break through rock and crumble it over the eons. Now, as it turns out, oxalic acid is two carbon dioxide molecules joined together. When they combine with the mineral, calcium, and form calcium oxalate, it sequesters carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, thus in building soils. I was astonished 2 weeks ago, Al Gore called me, and I gave a talk at TED, and afterwards Al Gore told me, Paul, you taught me something about global warming, I didn't know. This is what he was referring to. And Al is really tuned into, he's writing a new book called Solutions to Climate Change. He's really tuned into the role of fungi in building soils, and the fact that the loss of soils around the planet, as we all know, is leading to the collapse of the food chain. So I'm glad that these ideas are permeating to some really good brains that can even further build upon them. But here is an interesting fossil. 420 million years ago, this was the tallest organism on land. 420 million years ago, this fossil laying down is about 3 feet tall. It was before vascular plants had evolved. It was before trees, before flying insects. So lying down, this fossil, which the organism has been called Prototaxites. Prototaxites is the tallest organism on land lying down. Well, thankfully, it was discovered in 1859. It's been a subject of great dispute for over 150 years until Dr. Kevin Boyce, the Chicago Field Museum, published in the Journal of Geology in January of 2006 that Prototaxites was in fact giant mushrooms. Dotting across the planet, this planet, Prototaxites soared to more than 30 feet tall, towering over any other living organism. And across this planet was dotted giant fungi. And of course, at the time, electrostatic, there was a lot more lightning strikes. And of course, these would be attractive to lightning strikes. Who knows what happened in the evolutionary process from that type of stimulation. But they existed until 350 million years ago. And then they became extinct, probably because of insects. You know, we really don't know. So if we go back to 250 million years ago, the time of Pangaea, all the continents were connected. And so Prototaxites has been found in Quebec, it's been found in Northern Africa and Israel. Well, back then, Pangaea, that's not so far, they weren't, the continents were all together, so they weren't so far apart. So 250 million years ago, there was an enormous extinction event. We are now engaged in 6X, the sixth greatest extinction event known on this planet. But this is the first extinction event that's been caused by an organism. by humans. The other extinction events have been extraterrestrial or terrestrially based, related to geological events. There are three competing theories for the big extinction. It's called the PT boundary, the boundary of the Permian and the Triassic period, 250 billion years ago. One was an asteroid impact. You know, a lot of people subscribe to that theory. Another, and they found that methane hydrate burst from the sediments in the ocean and produced a toxic cloud of dust and caused more than 95% of the species on the planet to become extinct. And the third is in Eurasia, there were volcanoes that erupted. I don't see these as being mutually exclusive. An asteroid impact could have triggered enough earthquakes to have liberated the methane hydrate as well as caused the volcanoes. 3 years ago, a very interesting article was published. Prior to the PT boundary, the Permian Triassic boundary, the ratio of plant pollen to fungal spores was 10 to 1. Directly after the PT boundary, the fungal spores were 100% and there were no pollen spores. So when these impacts occurred, enormous amounts of debris was jettisoned in the atmosphere. Light was choked off, probably for decades, maybe hundreds of years, we don't know, causing a massive amount of extinction. Plants died, animals died, and fungi inherited the earth. Those organisms that paired with fungi survived, and they marched forward. We go to 65 million years ago, and we get hit again with another climatic changing, extinction causing event, another asteroid impact, which we know occurred. And same story. Enormous amounts of debris into the atmosphere, sunlight choked off, fungi re-inherited the earth. Through at least these two extinction events, we know that those organisms that paired with fungi survived. So this is where the second asteroid impact in this area, actually it's put up there, occurred. So I'm going to show you the earth today and some of the processes that we've come to understand. Here's the Columbia River, and where Dusty and I live is right about there. And in this area right here is where the largest organism in the world has been discovered. The largest organism in the world is a mycelial bat, 2,200 acres in size, 1,665 football fields and in surface area to a depth of 3 feet. It's a huge fungus. It's a mushroom-forming fungus. It's a honey mushroom called Armillaria estoicae. And this is the margins of the outline of this giant fungus. The trees have been killed, so the Forest Service came in and cut the trees because of forest fires. I'll be talking about this tomorrow. But think of that. The fungal mycelial mats and the fungal cells only have one cell wall that protect them from infection. We have five or six skin layers that protect us from infection. And yet the largest organism in the world is only one cell wall thick, and they can achieve these huge masses, surrounded by hundreds of millions of hungry microbes trying to consume them. How do they do that? It's because they're in constant biomolecular communication with this ecosystem. It's being able to articulate, sense, channel, and create defense mechanisms to allow these fungi to grow to such large masses. So in the right conditions, the mycelium then is triggered into mushroom formation. It's a little baby mushroom. So powerful mushrooms are, they can break through asphalt. It's a shaggy mane mushroom. Many of you are familiar with this. And so seeing these type of events over the years, seeing how paint becomes moldy and how diesel becomes moldy, and you know, many mycologists and scientists, including myself, started looking at what's called bioremediation with fungi or microremediation. And this is one of the experiments that we did. This is up in Bellingham, Washington, and the Department of Transportation had a toxic waste, you know, yard that was determined by the Department of Ecology. There are buses and trucks that were stored there for about 40 to 50 years. Oil leaked, you know, from those vehicles, saturated the soil. And then so the Department of Transportation was given an exemption for experimental methods for cleaning up this toxic waste. It was treated with enzymes. And then our third pile, we inoculated this pile with oyster mushroom mycelium. Notice how black the soil is. So upon contact, the mycelium absorbs the oil. And actually the mycelium becomes black in color. And the mycelium is producing extracellular acids and enzymes, particularly cellulases and lignases. These break carbon-hydrogen bonds, the same bonds that hold hydrocarbons together. So the mycelial mat actually absorbs the oil, becomes black, and then begins to digest it. We returned 6 weeks later. The control pile was dead, dark, and stinky, smelled like hydrocarbons, lifeless. Second pile treated with enzymes, same story, bacteria, same story. We came back to our pile, it was covered with hundreds of pounds of oyster mushrooms. And notice how the soil had become what we call blonde. It actually became light in color. And so the mushrooms then sporulated, and some of these mushrooms became huge. These are what we call happy mushrooms, because they are able to use the food resources in the habitat to create such a large, massive structure. And so when we analyzed the soil then afterwards, the parts per million of these toxic hydrocarbons went from 20,000 parts per million to less than 200 in the course of 8 weeks. Then it was approved by the Department of Transportation as being remediated and approved as soil for freeway landscaping. This was a major epiphany in my life, because in watching how it happened next really steered the course of my thinking. The mushrooms resisted rot up until sporulation. They sporulated and they began to rot. When we returned at around 8 to about 10 weeks later, the same other piles were dead, dark, and stinky, still at 20,000 parts per million of these hydrocarbons. But our pile suddenly went through a transformation. The mushrooms rotted with bacteria, but as the mushrooms sporulated, they attract flies. The flies laid eggs. The eggs became larvae. Birds came in after the larvae. They brought in seeds of plants. And our pile at 12 weeks, I don't have the last photograph, unfortunately, became an oasis of life. So these fungi broke down the toxic waste barriers, enabled ecological succession. And so I see these species as being gateway species that can break down toxic barriers and enable the proliferation of ecosystems that can lead to ecological recovery. So you can take an oyster mushroom kit, you can get one perhaps from David or from any company, we sell them too. But after it stops producing, after a few flushes, you can take the crankcase oil out of your car, you can pour it on an old oyster mushroom kit, and more mushrooms will grow. So, you know, because of the metal tailings in the crankcase, and because mushrooms do hyperaccumulate heavy metals, we don't recommend that you consume these mushrooms. But as a proof of concept, we analyzed the mushrooms, they have no hydrocarbons left whatsoever. We believe they actually break down hydrocarbons and they reform them into fungal carbohydrates. And about 80% of these mushrooms, 60 to 80% of these mushrooms, are fungal carbohydrates. So this really has been an eye-opener for the use of fungi for habitat restoration. So what happens is we basically take dead plant material, we add mycelium, ultimately we create soil. But the worms, red wiggly worms in particular, are extremely mycophagous. They love to eat mycelium. And so what I noticed, and we're working with Mattel Laboratories, they said, well, Paul, we'll first do the worm toxicity test. And I go, well, what's that? I said, well, we take a toxic soil, we throw 100 worms, red wiggly worms, in the soil, and we see what happens. Up in Bellingham, Washington, they all immediately died. And the idea was, you see if they die, or if they live, they reproduce, if your offspring continue to reproduce, or they die. It's called the worm toxicity test. I said, that's really interesting. And so when we did our remediation experiment in Bellingham, Washington, sure enough, the worm toxicity test, the worms all lived. And the pile became infused with red wiggly worms who gobbled up the mycelium. So I thought, that's really interesting. Let's see where in the scientific literature is there a worm choice test. And I have scoured, and anybody here who's a literature hound, please help me. I have spent hours trying to find a choice test of worms preferring non-myceliated substrate like sawdust, you see here, versus with mycelium. In this case, we use two fungi. We use a oyster mushroom mycelium. Here's sterilized sawdust, the same sawdust, same day, same moisture content, inoculated with oyster mushroom mycelium. I put 100 worms in the center of a box. 24 hours later, we watch where they migrate. We did this 7 times, 100 worms in the center, so high numbers. The significance value for those of you who are involved in statistics is ridiculously significant. And we found that sure enough, 43% of the worms would migrate to the mycelium on the sawdust versus only 4.5% would migrate to sterilized sawdust. Well, why is this important? This is important because it shows you that the path to soil generation is largely controlled at the endpoints by worms, and the worms' preferences for myceliated habitats go a long way in our understanding how to build good soils. So So this leads me to the point that I keep coming back to. The problem with the scientific method and the scientific state of knowledge today, I believe, is that the wrong decision is made at the beginning of the decision tree. They're the wrong presumptions. Every student in this audience, you can challenge your professor. If you challenge a legitimate authority, that a legitimate authority should not be offended. They should be delighted by the fact that you have spunk to be able to challenge them. And if you have authorities that then put you down or dissuade you from these type of questions, I think they need to get replaced. So, I encourage all of you here, it's a very simple science experiment. Do the worm choice test. You know, understand how worms, you know, as the sawdust becomes myceliated, there's fungal sugars, of course it's more appetizing, but I couldn't find a single report in the scientific literature on the preference of worms using this method. And I this is a sorry state of affairs. Okay, so this is where Dusty and I live. We have Tumulty Point, Washington on Skookum Inlet. And I actually hired an airplane, went up in the airplane, and I told the pilot I'm going to do something because I couldn't get the right photograph, and he flew around again. He goes, "What are you going to do?" And I told him, "I paid you." And so I opened up the door of the airplane and I stepped out of the airplane holding onto the seatbelt, but it was one of those slip seatbelts. And I slipped out of the airplane, but I held my Nikon camera and took this photo. But when we moved here, every landowner, you know, after about 5 weeks after I moved there, was served a summons by the sheriff's department. The sheriff showed up in my driveway 5 weeks after I moved there. I thought that was really quick. And and he said, "You've been served a summons, Mr. Stamets." And I go, "What did I do?" And he goes, "Well, Ed, you have to have a septic system installed and inspected within 2 years, or you'd be physically vacated off your land." This extremely rich shellfish area. Clams and oysters go there prolifically. It's the largest producing shellfish area in North America. And but the landowners were polluting with E. coli into this area. So all the landowners had to put in a septic system that was approved and inspected. I had cows, chickens, and pigs, as most of you all know. They had more than double the next year. And so they came back the next year, and they did a water test along the Skookum Inlet. They came to our property, and they did a water test. And the county officials came back again. And they said, "You're an anomaly. We have to talk to you. What happened?" And what'd you do? I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you have more animals than you had before, but you're the only property that had a 2-log reduction, a 100-fold reduction of E. coli coming up for a property. What did you do?" I said, "Well, what I did is I put in beds of wood chips. Then I inoculated it with mycelium, and the mycelium would grow through the wood chips, and I created what I call microfiltration membranes using sheet mulch. That's basically what it is. And so this led to the dawning of microfiltration, which then gave me a Department of Ecology grant, and this has been such a really slow and long process. But I want to show you something that many of you can do very, very easily to clean up the downstream effects of your farms, either coming in to your own property or downstream from your property to someplace else. Now, at the time that I did this, this is the garden giant mushroom. These are 5-pound mushrooms. These are huge. And so it's called Struvaria rugosa annulata. It's a wonderful, delicious mushroom. When it's young, you do have it native to this area. It has an incredible appetite for bacteria. And so this is a little swale that my daughter was sitting in. And so you can take the garden giant mushroom, and we discovered something, and many other people, you know, I found out over the years have discovered the same thing. But the garden giant mushroom has these rhizomorphs at the base of the stem. These are these lengths of mycelium that gives rise to the mushroom. Well, it turns out, if you cut the mushroom here and you throw it into the ground, you get lots of other organisms that grow on it as well. But if you take the stem bud and you cut it off and you put it into corrugated cardboard, which you've soaked, you break the stem bud up into little pieces, you sandwich it, you come back 4 weeks later, and you've got running mycelium. Mycelium running. And so the mycelium is now running, and the cardboard is selectively favorable to mushroom type of mycelium, as opposed to mold fungi. So there's a very simple way of getting what I call acclimated mycelium. Mycelium that's in contact with microbes that have a genetic memory and immune system fight off microbes. We can get it to run upon cardboard. Then we put wood chips upon the cardboard. And now you've gone full circle from a natural mushroom into generating a mycelial mat that you can then put into burlap sacks, and the burlap sacks then become infused with mycelium, and then you can take burlap sacks downstream from farms or from factories, and you create what I call bumper spawn, microfiltration membranes that leads to habitat recovery. And so we have been doing this now in Mason County for the past 5 years intensively. This is Dusty with an oyster mushroom that we found up valley from a farm. And the farmer was, the conservation district came to us saying, this is a really nice farmer. He's a third, fourth generation farmer. His farm is the main source of E. coli going into one of the main bays, Oakland Bay, near Shelton, Washington. The health department has not discovered who the farmer is. We have. Can you help them? Because once the health department discovers, they are have to find this person, put them on notice. We met with the farmer and we said, hey, we'll try to help you out. So before we did that, I surveyed, and this little chart here cost me $25,000. I should say, cost us $25,000. Thank you, Dusty. You trust me with money, thankfully. So this is a logarithmic scale. 10 to the first power is 10. 10 to the second power is 100. 10 to the sixth power is a million. 100 million colonies of E. coli in a milliliter of water, 1 gram of water, and staph. 100 million colonies of staph in 1 gram, 1 milliliter of water. And in 24 to 48 hours, we found three fungi, the pearl oyster, the birch polypore, which you have here, and agaricon, the mushroom I was holding up earlier, caused the E. coli and the staph to have a 99.99% plus inhibition, going from 100 million colonies in milliliter of water to 100 in 24 hours, to 48 hours. So we knew that in our culture library, we had three species that significantly had antimicrobial, antibacterial properties. So we selected the oyster mushroom because it's resident in every riparian ecosystem in the world, practically. And so we knew it was good. We had good cultures of it. So we put 350 bags of burlap sacks, you know, just before Oakland Bay, which is right here. And the farmers here, and this we use a laser level. And so there's a sheet flow of water coming through the burlap sacks. We staggered them 1.5 times high. And so now this is the flow rate that's going through these ditches. Many of you may not know that 95% of the pollution that makes it into the estuaries, it makes it into the rivers, the lakes, comes from ditches. And parking lots are by far the worst. You go to Walmart, all those cars are leaking, rain comes, goes in the storm drain, goes in the ditch, goes into water. So we found that the oyster mushrooms not only broke down hydrocarbons, but captured bacteria. So this water, if it was in real time, it would be flowing like about like this. So it was flowing down through. So we located this site, and we put in 20 burlap sacks. The data was collected by the Mason County Department of Health, because after we cleaned up the farmer's effluent, the Department of Health was contacted. The farmer was no longer had his neck in the noose. He was no longer a source of pollution. The Department of Health got really excited and said, Paul, Dusty, can you do this elsewhere in Mason County? We have a lot of problems. So Dusty and I organized our crew, and we've done now, we've provided almost 700 bags in Mason County over the past year and a half, at every ditch that we can find that leads into the saltwater Puget Sound. So here's before microfiltration, this amount of E. coli, 240, 900, 1610. So this is directly afterward. Now we did six samples here, six samples down here. Look what happens. Now, not as dramatic as 10,000 to one, but realize this is flowing through in a real setting. This is not a Petri dish test. 240 before, 30 afterwards. This one 50 to 60, this one 30 to 110. Now that back end is going to be a hot spot. But overall, significantly major reduction in the amount of coliforms, 1600 to 240. We are still evolving this process. We have now created the microfiltration project installation guides. Any of you who want to contact us, we can send you a little package on how to do this on your own farm. You can do this with stem buds of oyster mushrooms or the garden giant. So you don't have to buy spawn from anyone. This just shows you different staking methods. These are fish friendly, so because in Washington State, fish migration is a huge issue. And so we had 5 inches of rain in one day. And this is an example of one of the ditches, and we were able to hold back the much of the pollution, and we found something else that it precipitated the silt, which is a huge issue for salmon migration, is the pebbles, if they become silted over, then the eggs won't take. And so we ended up setting up these weirs and setting up the microfiltration, and here is a map of Mason County. And we are here, and these are the spots that we have now put these 20 to 30 bags of these burlap sacks. And this spot right here is Hoodsport, Washington, they've not been able to legally harvest shellfish from Hoodsport, Washington for the past 5 years until this year.
Wow.
And nothing that the Department of Ecology could do resulted in a positive effect as of this one did. So this is now taken off around the country. We have a few places in Massachusetts and elsewhere. We're looking for other sites. We want to get 100 sites around the United States. We emphasize that you work with the conservation district. We need third-party analysis. We will shepherd and help people to go through this process, but we want proof of concept all across North America, so this be recommended as a best management practice, a new best management practice. And you farmers, you can use your corn stalks, you can use wheat, you can use thatch, you can use all sorts of cellulosic material. You're not bound just to wood chips. The grasses decompose a lot faster. The wood chips are staying resident in the bag for about 6 months to a year before we have to replenish it. But nature subsidizes. We can be guaranteed we have storms. And so what we did is, all of us have gone past, the big asphalt trucks, that are chipping the down trees and making all these wood chips, wondering what they're going to do with them. And so we joined the department, the Public Works Department, that's involved in clearing the roads of down trees and chipping the wood, with the Mason County Health Department, with the Conservation District, and we put mycelium in the middle. And by doing that, we have three government organizations now, all dedicated to a common solution. And so because nature subsidizes the storms and the storm debris, the utility companies and other companies are already involved in clearing and chipping the wood, there are virtually very little cost to this, approximately $2 per bag. And I'm a strong advocate that we should get prison labor, we should get prisoners out of the penitentiaries, and get them involved in something that's pro-environmental, positive for society, and get them back to work. Because I think this is a very helpful thing for them to be able to see. So then mushrooms form out of the burlap sacks. Now you have more stem buds. You can propagate the process. You can move it forward. Or you can add seeds of grasses and trees. In this case, of a little conifer tree, you can set up a little ecosystem, little mycopods, biopods. You can articulate habitat recovery and steer ecological evolution by inserting the indigenous plants that you want to have grow in your ecosystem. Every year, the wood chips decompose. 10 inches of wood chips go to about 1 inch of soil in 1 year using mycelium. It's a good rule of thumb. And so then we just basically go uphill. And said, what the farmers told me, this is so much better than these buffers that we have to put hundreds of feet, out of farming. We only need 2 to 3 feet of these burlap sacks. And that, to me, that really told me a lot, that this was a space-conservative method. And then, in a matter of a few years, about 7 years later, these are hybrid poplar trees are surging through the burlap sacks. Burlap sacks are totally decomposed. And so let's go back to this other fungus. And this is the Garrocon, Fomitopsis officinalis, very similar to the one that I was holding up earlier. This one is on the red list of extinction in Europe. And this is a mushroom that was first described by Dioscorides in 65 AD in the very first Materia Medica. And he described it as a treatment against consumption. Later, one of the forms of consumption, later to be known as tuberculosis. And so this mushroom is nearly extinct in the world, only growing in a few deep parts of the old growth forest. So we have dedicated an enormous amount of our resources. I calculate now over $400,000 specifically to save as many strains of this fungus as possible. And this mushroom does have anti-tubercular activities. And tuberculosis is a pernicious disease. It takes a very long time for you. The sickness duration period is very long. Bird flu is wonderful because it kills you so quickly, but tuberculosis takes forever to kill you, and it's extremely expensive for the hospitals as well as healthcare. And not, it doesn't have to be on the side of diseases, but it just happens to be a fact. So we knew we would have anti-tuberculosis activities, and in January of last year, the National Geographic Adventure magazine gave me the Greenovator Award. I still don't know really what that means. But they decided, they said, let's send out a reporter and a photojournalist, let's do a story on you. They wanted to go out and come out in January. I said, it's impossible to come out and go mushroom hunting in January in Washington State. You know, we have 16 feet of snow in the mountains. And so I said, what's your mountain in July? And so Dusty took this photograph, and we rented this little motor sailor, and this is on a Zodiac. And this is up in British Columbia. And so what we did is we went up the inland passage of Desolation Sound. And Dusty and I have a cabin on Cortez Island. And we go up the inland passage. These are all old growth forests. Now, it turns out agaricon grows on Douglas fir trees primarily. But these are sentinel, huge living snags, hundreds of years old, that are broken off the tops, oftentimes where bald eagles are sitting upon. They're snap top old growth trees. Very easy to see them from a distance. So the reporter asked me, well, how likely is it that you're going to find the agaricon? And I frankly lied. I said, oh, 50-50. In fact, it was about 100-1. And because we've gone out hundreds and hundreds of times, and now we're better. We probably find it one out of every 10 times that we go out, because we've narrowed our hunting skills. But I didn't want to dissuade him, so he flew out, and we took him out on this motor sailor, and we went up Desolation Sound. You know, I tried to be optimistic. And it did not look good at all. And so our skipper said, well, you want to look at some pictographs? And we said, sure. And so the First Coast Indians, you know, had a lot of pictographs, and here is a site which is about 30-foot overhang. The pictograph right there. So we motor into this pictographic site, and when we get there, lo and behold, we find a agaricon in the tree. And this is what we found. This is a really cool specimen, because it actually was growing up here and fell. When it was alive, hit the tree, it then regrew its mycelium back into the trunk, and then it grew two legs. So it's like, whoa, we found it. That's really cool. And so oftentimes agaricon has the Venus of Willendorf form. And so in Lumen Pharmacopoeia, in the very first Materia Medicus, you know, the doctrine of signatures, you know, if it looks like the what you intend to treat, then, you know, it's just useful for that. So it has this chalk-like appearance. And so it's also highly revered by the Haida culture. So on our trip, Dr. Scott Franzblau, who's the director of the Institute for Tuberculosis Research at University of Chicago, came with us, and I took these small tubes because I don't have to harvest the conch. So we go there. There's Dr. Scott Franzblau. This is the pictograph, you know, that was painted by Native peoples hundreds of years ago. And in the Haida culture, this is from an argillite plate from the Haida Gwaii, formerly called the Queen Charlotte Islands. They don't like to call it the Queen Charlotte Islands after British Columbia, because that's the name of the boat that brought smallpox that decimated the Haida culture from 50,000 people to 500 in 3 years. But in 1894, Charles Edenshaw of the royal family carved this into an argillite plate, and this speaks to the origination myth of women in the Haida culture. And here's Raven paddling on a canoe. He's over 110 years old, paddling on a canoe. And the legend is very specific. She's seeking her genitalia. No member of the ecological community, the killer whale, the bear, the eagle, no one could help Raven succeed in her quest except for agaricon. And so the Haida recognized agaricon, you know, as being an extremely important medicinal mushroom. So much so that they carved agaricon into little wooden, little figurines to place on shamans' graves. These also were at the Chicago Fields Museum, sat there for over 100 years, until Nancy Turner, a well-known ethnobotanist and a group of the mycologists, looked at this and said, these are not made of wood, these are made from a fungus, because it was never reported what they were made from. And so the Haida revered agaricon as a spiritual ally to help shamans go into the spirit world. And it has some very wonderfully colorful names in the Haida culture. So we get closer, and here it is. There is a pictograph, and then this really old tree is here. But look right there. And so we go, and we see this giant rock. And we get closer to the rock, and I'm looking at the rock, and here's the rock,
here's a Garakon. Here's a rock, here's a Garakon. Here's a rock, here's a Garakon. I'm kind of slow at these things sometimes. I have to do this a few times. Here's the rock, here's a Garakon. So how likely is it that we would find a Garakon? Oh, 100 to 1. How likely is it that we'd find a Garakon at a pictographic site? Oh, I don't know, maybe 1,000 to 1. The Haida, you know, knew that this had anti-consumption like properties, anti-respiratory properties. Now, how likely we would find it with a rock that looks like a Garakon? I'm not a geologist, but I really want to talk to a geologist to see and take them there to see if this has been carved or not. Because I think this is shamanistically an extremely powerful place. And then how likely is it that we'd find it on my birthday? At this point, the photojournalist turns to a friend of mine and said, does this happen to Paul often? And my friend said, yes. And this, I think, speaks to Vision Quest. All of us are involved in Vision Quest. Every time we go out in the forest or to look for a plant, to look for a mushroom, it's intention. And if your heart is true and your spirit is true and you have this kid-like wonderment, kids never grow up. You have such a precious opportunity being a child. Never lose that childlike wonder. It steers you all through your life, and it makes things like this happen. So we were able to get a Garakon. To give you an idea, this is how big these trees are. And from that tree came that specimen. So we got a Garakon into culture. Here's my weird brother Bill, he's from Chicago. He's a city boy, doesn't have a driver's license, we can go about that. He's looking up at a Garakon, and there is the biggest Garakon that we have found. And it's up in this tree here. I'll get a closer view. This is a 700-year-old old-growth Douglas fir. And so there's a friend of mine, Scott Baker, is a tree climber. And so here is this modified fishing rod, and here's like a hacky sack with a slingshot. And 100 feet up goes Scott, climbing up the old-growth tree. And then he's up there, and then we are able to get a culture of this fungus. This is the oldest and biggest one we know. This thing is about 100 years old, and it's so strange that this fungus always grows, almost always grows on limbs. But why would a fungus grow and rot the limb that supports it? Well, it turns out that these limbs become calcified with calcium oxalate. So they become petrified. So the fungus, even though it causes the core rot in the middle of a tree, its superstructure that supports it becomes petrified in the course of the mycelium growing through it. This one is massive, it is huge, and we were able to get it into culture. There's the two tubes that we take. That's all the amount of tissue that we need to get. And then we take this and we put it into petri dishes. So before I begin this, we take this amount of tissue, we put it into a petri dish, now we've saved that strain. And if the tree is destroyed by a fire or whether other habitat catastrophe, this helps to preserve the strain, as you'll see very shortly. This is extremely important. So here's a short little movie clip that Dusty helped me make. And this is from last October. And I think it speaks for itself. So are you ready for the audio up there? Because I think it's coming. Okay.
October 27, 2008, we just started leaving Brightbush Hot Spring.
Can you turn it up?
Saw a beautiful growth forest, and we came in here. And then we saw a blue tag basically saying that this entire forest is going to be cut. So we're 200 feet away from the road, beautiful old growth forest, and we're hiking in here and we find an old friend. And this is Fomi Thompson officinalis, the Garakon, otherwise known as a quinine fungus. This area is going to be totally destroyed here in the next year. It's a perfect opportunity for us to get another strain in the culture. This one's probably about 40 or 50 years old. It's still alive at the bottom here. We would normally just take a small piece of tissue and about the size of my fingernail and take it back to the laboratory. But in this case, the loggers are going to totally destroy the situation here, so we may as well harvest it. Harvesting this is easier said than done, or maybe not. Look at this. It's giving itself up. Look how easy that is. Whoa. It just gave itself up. And so it's this tissue here that we'll get the culture from. That was sweet.
So indeed, this forest has been cut. This fungus would have been, the strain would have been lost. This is the FO14. We now have 24 strains of Fomi Thompson officinalis or Garakon in culture. The rule of nature is strains differ, as you gardeners and farmers know. And so we're looking at strains that are super potent. Now, we put these strains into culture and we challenge them to other strains to see if they're the same strain. It could be the same strain growing in the same place in the forest. And these barrier lines show zones of resistance, which means that there are different phenotypes. These are uniquely different individuals. So a very simple test that we do in culture. So I became involved in the BioShield program with the U.S. Defense Department about 6-7 years ago. Actually, it was directly after 2001, so time flies. And the BioShield program was set up after 9/11, specifically because of bioterrorism threats. And they identified smallpox as being by far the biggest threat on the horizon that bioterrorists could use. We do know that laboratories in the breakaway republics of Russia did indeed sell strains of smallpox to Al-Qaeda. And so if they're willing to blow up buildings, they could be willing to spread a pandemic. So we submitted over 600 specimens to date to the BioShield program. Dr. Earl Kern is a specialist of smallpox, and he stated that this is called the selectivity index number. I won't get into this, but basically any that's two or more significant, 10 or greater or more significant, to be extremely active. And so our raw extracts, not purified, raw extracts, when we challenged them against pox viruses, we found it to be very, very significant against orthopoxes. Those of you born after 1968, you have no immunity against smallpox. If there was a smallpox pandemic today, within 2 weeks, 30% of you would die, 30% of you would be horribly scarred, and 30% of you would be blind, 10% of you would survive. It's actually from a group of African villagers who told Mary Montagu in the early 1700s about the fact that it was well known that milk maidens would not get smallpox because they would have cowpox blisters on their hands. That then became what was later to be known as vaccination. And so those of us from African descent or European descent, where we have a history of contact with cows, we have a better immunity than Native Americans. Over 95% of Native Americans will die from contact with smallpox because they don't have the history of contact with cows that Europeans and Africans have. And the US government and the British government were actively involved in bioterrorism in the 1800s against Native peoples. Oftentimes, when treaties were signed, smallpox-infected blankets were given as quote-unquote gifts, and the military strategists fully knew they could come back within a year and walk into those villages and not have to fight the Indians. So we must not forget our history. But in the course of this research, then we went on to flu viruses, using a Garrocon as well, flu B viruses. Now our selectivity index numbers soar into the hundreds, compared to ribavirin, pure pharmaceutical, placed side by side. Now our extracts are being diluted 1 to 5, 5 to 25, 5 to 125, 125 to 625. They do a dilution sequence to see where the activity comes and falls off. Compared to a pure pharmaceutical, ribavirin, against flu viruses, flu Bs, flu As, and then we did a combination against H5N1, and our selectivity index soared to more than 1,000 compared to ribavirin, which is 32. We have now been able to make the argument, and thankfully it's been very well received by the U.S. Defense Department, that we should save the old growth forest as a matter of national defense. Of course, this is not national defense, it's international defense. The virus has no borders. I've been speaking on this subject now for 7 or 8 years, and a group of virologists and myself that have been involved in this research have been predicting a pandemic. All of us have been wondering, stating publicly, many of us, why we hadn't had to have a pandemic earlier. The number one threat the BioShield program saw in the United States was factory farms. A bioterrorist could go through a vial of a virus into a factory farm, and the virus would breed out from there. Well, that sort of looked like it happened. Maybe not from a bioterrorist per se, but a factory farm with pigs in Mexico. I think we will see pandemic storms on the horizon as a normal seasonal occurrence. This is the beginning of a pandemic storm season. It'll be H1N1, it'll be H5N1, it'll be these different viruses recombining. And now they have so many loci, they have so many different points of recombination. And when you get sick, oftentimes you get sick from more than one virus at one time. That is oftentimes more. Symptomatically, and when the virus can be typed by a physician, yes, they can identify it. But the search for new antivirals is critically important. In the past 4 weeks, we've been working for all these years with the National Center for Naturopathic Research at the University of Mississippi. We have been able to finally, after many, many years, and I do want to thank the U.S. government, which NCNPR is owned by the U.S. government. They discovered Taxol, or co-discovered it. You know, they grow the marijuana there, not very good. and things like that. So, but it's from this research, it was unanticipated, that we have now navigated to a new class of antiviral medicines that are coming from mushrooms. Now, this is really important because the majority of the victims of the H1N1 pandemic, of the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, died from bacteria. They got a virus first, and they had a cytokine storm, but then the bacteria grew in their lungs, and they died from strep and staph. So the majority of people don't die from the viral infection, but secondary infections, opportunistically for the bacteria that are all over you. So to find a new class of antiviral agents resident within these mushrooms that also have antibacterial properties is medically significant. So we believe we're on the path, and we are spending much of our energy and money as possible to get as many strains of agarikon in the culture, because we know these strains vary substantially. Now that we have identified the active principal ingredients, and there's a consortium of them, there's synergy between four different groups of constituents of anti-inflammatory properties. We are very close, and the NIH has approved us for animal studies, and we hope to be able to be into human studies in the next 2 years. We're going at this as rapidly as we can, but Dustin and I own a very small company. Besides the BioShield program, we've received no financial support whatsoever from anyone else. So the majority of our profits within our company are spent specifically on this type of research. Now fungi entice insects. This is a ant mound in Washington State, a thatch ant mound. There's a lepiota mushroom. It was discovered that A-time ants started growing lepiota mushrooms over 300 million years ago. And the ants then cultivate these mushroom species because they have an antibacterial property that sets the stage for a group of organisms that prevent Ascomycetes, a fungal parasite of ant colonies. So the fungi select the bacterium that then selects that the bacterium has an antifungal property against an invasive fungus. So these ants figured out a long time ago that if you cultivate fungi, then you can go a long ways in being able to prevent diseases. So Dusty being very trusting, I'm the photographer. I grew up some lepiota mycelium. We went to a thatch ant mound. I said, Dusty, now you destroy the mound, and I'm going to throw some mycelium on top. I said, but when you destroy the mound, the ants are not going to be happy. They're going to attack you. And they're going to come up the shovel, and they're going to try to bite you by the hundreds. And she goes, really? This is not very exciting. I said, that's okay, because this is for science, and trust me, I'm your husband. She did that. Sure enough, the massive response to the ant colony, we threw down the lepiota mycelium, and within 30 seconds, the ants stopped their attack. They immediately began to rebuild their nest with the mycelium, and a few hours later, the nest was fully rebuilt with the mycelium incorporated. And then we thought, that was cool. That was really interesting. Dusty was happy also, she didn't get bit. And then the next year, these giant mushrooms showed up on our property. That's my grandson, Trevon. And then the more mushrooms started coming up. These are delicious edible mushrooms called Lepiota procera, the parasol mushroom. And then hundreds of mushrooms started coming up. And so now we've established a patch of these mushrooms on our property, and they've been there for 6 to 7 years. And the ants are now spreading the mycelium all around. The satellite colonies are now incorporating these fungi because it's part of the host defense of resistance. You know, a central theme here is you can gauge fungi to potentiate host defense of disease resistance. And then we give these to our friends, and the stem butts we grow. So you don't have to culture of a spawn. You just get one of these mushrooms, you clip off the base of the stem, and you put it into cardboard, or you put it directly into an ant mound. So I was fascinated by this dialectic between fungi and ants. Now, the agarikon mushroom, when it rots off the tree, then insects come in. And the insects come in, and then the woodpeckers come in after the insects. And so I've been asked, well, what's the molecular bridge between agaricon and smallpox? Agaricon and the bird flu. The mushrooms are in the old growth forest. Well, I think the molecular bridge could be the fact that fungus rots the tree and bites the insects that prefer myceliated wood. The insects then set up home. The woodpeckers then come after the insects. They create cavity habitats by pounding their head for some reason against the wood for a long time. And then what happens then? So then the myceliated, the woodpeckers then create the cavity habitats. The spotted owl then can set up residence. And then the spotted owl's primary victim are flying squirrels. Flying squirrels are going on down into the dump to harvest truffles, which is their mainstay, as well as voles. So the molecular bridge could be from mouse pox or voles up channeling through to the spotted owl, and then it going back into agaricon habitat in the old growth tree. And it serves the best interest of the Douglas fir tree to have agaricon associated with it for hundreds of years. Because again, it speaks to the plurality of the ecosystem. This is not a tree by itself, this is a tree that holds a community. So I just need about 15 more minutes and I'll finish here. So our former house has been destroyed by carpenter ants. So I went on the Environmental Protection Agency homepage to look up a group of entomopathogenic fungi that kill insects, that the EPA was favorable towards. And I came to this group called Metarhizium. It is bee-friendly, does not harm bees. In fact, it's been used now to control Vero mites and beehives. It has a uniquely interesting effect in killing termites, carpenter ants, and all sorts of other bugs that plague urban and suburban environments. So here I was horrified when I got the cultures, because they were mold-forming cultures. In our laboratories, we have new mold spores flying around. So this is not my specialty. This is something that I came to the back door on. And then when I saw these little sectors, these little white fans form, I thought, great, I'm going to run with these sectors. So I subcultured from here to create cultures that were non-sporulate. Everyone in the scientific literature said, don't do this. You're leading to senescence, the inability of the fungus to reproduce its spores. Don't go there. And they went to the route of potentiating spores, more missiles, more death. So I was able to morph the culture from this state to this in a matter of a few weeks. And then with my daughter's Barbie doll dish, this is what I would do every morning. Every morning, Paul Stamets' ritual for over 10 years was to make a cup of espresso and then go vacuum part of my house that was consumed by carpenter ants the night before. So I've been drinking my coffee. I've come to this one section here, this Douglas fir needles, and there's an enormous parade of carpenter ants going back and forth into my house. They're especially nocturnal. So I thought, well, I'm going to trick the carpenter ants. Now, it was well known that spores kill carpenter ants and fire ants and termites, but when they try to develop base stations around houses, the insects aren't stupid. They can smell the plague when they got close to these sporulating traps, and they turn around and run away. So over $50 million was spent on creating bait traps specifically to get rid of termites around people's houses and carpenter ants, and they all failed because of the repellency property of spores. So I made great theater of this with my daughter, and with Dusty said, we're gonna trick the carpenter ants. And so I grew out the mycelium on rice, as you see here. I put it down around 9:30 at night in the summertime. And fortunately, my daughter, who was 16 at the time, had to use the bathroom around midnight. And she actually walked away from her path to go check out the little Barbie doll dish. She looked down, she couldn't believe what she saw. She said, Dad, Dusty, you gotta see this, come quickly. And this is basically what she saw. The ants were swarming on the mycelium, otherwise repelled if they had any spores. So we watched the ants pick up fragments of the mycelium, and we saw them carry it back into the house. 1 week later, I was actually quite disappointed. I'm having my espresso, I go over with my vacuum cleaner, and there's no dust mites from carpenter ants. And I killed the carpenter ants. I thought, this is very interesting. So I told a friend of mine, and I said, you know, I have a patent here, I think. And he goes, you certainly do have a patent. And so he is a patent attorney. And so we started doing more work, and the ants then pick up the mycelium, and they go through this, they can become lethargic. They become poor at cleaning themselves. They become infected with the fungus. They become myceliated. And then the ant colonies die. And what happens is they pick up the fragments of mycelium, they go past the guards. These are factory fortresses. And the guards are at the entrances, and if there's a single spore on a worker returning from outside, the guards will capture that worker, take it to a graveyard, decapitate that worker, and then the guards stay in the graveyard themselves and die, because they've been in contact with this fungus. Every carpenter ant termite colony in the world has a graveyard, and every graveyard is this metarhizing fungus. It is ubiquitous. Over hundreds of millions of years, it's been a deadly dance of dinner and death between the insects and this fungus, and so they're co-evolving very, very rapidly. So I was able to get rid of the carpenter ants in our house. Then my Aunt Louise, it's true, my Aunt Louise had an ant problem, and she said, and she's like 87 years of age, she said, well, Paul, can you help me? The family house is being destroyed by carpenter ants. I said, well, you know, EPA gives exemptions for your own house for scientists. Okay, I can try. So I played this for the EPA. They loved it. So hopefully the audio will be louder this time. So here is a voice recording that I received from my Aunt Louise after I gave her some of this fungus. And this is about a week and a half later. So here she goes. And then, he said, this is not my specialty. And this it begins to, you know, again, challenge authority. And every step in the decision tree, ask why. Hundreds of other scientists worked on this and missed it. But then something amazing occurs with these ants. Under the right conditions, boing, a mushroom spots and pumps out of his head. And so this is a cordyceps mushroom. This fungus is what's called a dimorphic fungus. It's got a mushroom state and a mold state. It causes the carpenter ants in the tropics to climb to the top of the canopy of trees, locks its mandible into a tree, and then boing, a mushroom comes out of it, and the spores then fly far and wide. So a very good, you know, method of getting insects to carry the spore mass high in the tree, then where it dies in the sporulence. So the house came down, put a happy face on it. I got my first patent that was approved against carpenter ants, fire ants, and termites, and with using this fungus. Then we did choice tests for extracts. Then I was given a second patent against all social insects. Doesn't mean that I'm going to use it against all social insects. I wouldn't use it against bees. I'd use it to help bees. But because I proved it worked with eight insects, it's been called a paradigm shifting Alexander Graham Bell discovery, because it totally steers the pesticide industry in a whole new direction. I believe these suites of inventions can totally revamp and destroy the chemical petrochemical basis of the pesticide industry throughout the world. And it's using a nature-based system. The Australian Patent Office ruled 3 months ago, and they gave me all entomopathogenic fungi prior to sporulation against all insects. Now, because the extracts are so powerful, I can steer beneficial insects into different locations. One of my dreams is to use these big foggers they use in Florida to prevent frosting and in the orchards, and they probably use them up here, to be able to send out these extracts of these micro-attractants to bring in insects. I'd love to bring a locust plague into a 55-gallon drum. You know, I think that we have that power. These fungi, I mean, they evolve some very powerful aromatic compounds that entice their victims to come closer and closer, and then smash them. So, now where this is leading is that insects carry diseases. You know, insects and mosquitoes carry West Nile virus. Well, SARS came from civet cats. Civet cats kill chickens. SARS viruses combined with H1N1 and H5N1 viruses. The chickens can have mosquitoes upon them. They can infect ducks. They can land in your pond and kill your family. So by using a platform of mycotechnology, such as I'm describing today, as a unifying principle of mycological knowledge that creates a system of synergism that can have a dramatically positive impact on the health for our lives and for our families and for the other organisms in the world. So I thought, how am I going to get this out into the world? So I thought, aha, I love cardboard. So we all get too many cardboard boxes in the mail. So I created the Life Box. And here's the aftermath of our footprints as we walk through life and ecological recovery hopefully occurs. And so in the corrugations of cardboard, I put in this case, there's 8 garden seeds with a plurality of mycorrhizal, endophytic, and saprophytic fungi. And the first fungi that grow unifies all the seeds together, very happy seeds here, a mantle of mycelium mothers this group of seeds, and it's infused in the cardboard, so if you get a disc, you know, of this conference, you know, you can get it, and then you can plant the cardboard box. You can water it. It's my grandson, and we have created an old growth forest and a Life Box. So I told him, your grandson's grandkids will be able to walk through an old growth forest that you started today. Without hesitating, he said, cool. He knew it immediately, you know, or his granddaughter. So here's his old growth forest that Trevon is growing. And we have birch and beech, and we have Doug's fir and pines, and we have hemlocks and cedars coming up. And so he's totally into this, and I'm growing little baby trees. Kids like babies. This is something that I think all of us can relate to. I know that I became a biologist the day in kindergarten when my sunflower seed germinated and spread its cotton-leaving leaves into the sun. I felt like God, you know? And I think kids really relate to this. So he's explanting it in little pots, put the little babies down, and then last week we put them into bigger pots, and so we're on our way. And so the idea here is a 1% share of cardboard in the United States can cover 25,000 acres per week. And with zip code store sorting with Amazon.com, you can pick this, you can target ecological recovery using a suite of indigenous plants that were on the decline, or to help bees in a certain area with flowers, or to help replenish the ecosystem with trees that are being harmed because of other issues. And so we can then be able to use the postal system, UPS and FedEx. There's no extra weight. The delivery system's already in place. And then we can add a garicon to the spore mass of the trees. We can add metarhizium fungi. We can add lepiota spores to be able to help the ants to be able to grow these things, you know, in harmony with these fungi. And so one day I hope that we'll be able to walk through an old growth forest, or my descendants will, and perhaps your descendants will be able to share a walk through the old growth forest. So we can take the box, we can add corns, beans, and squash, and onions. I'm not a gardener, so my wife was really amused for me trying to do this. I took 2 buckets. I took an old bathtub, a toilet, the proverbial kitchen sink. And then I grew my own garden from a Life Box. And then you grow really big onions. If Daryl Hannah helps you with Dusty. And so then Dusty said, you know, I can harvest this. She goes, no, it's a seed garden, Paul. You have enough for a small farm. I said, really? This is really a fantastic potential now, because we'll be able to do this all over the world.
and be able to establish seed gardens, and whoever grows the best light box in the community can be rewarded. For instance, you know, at refugee camps, they have more resources, so we can create teachers of teachers of teachers about utilizing plants and fungi within the ecosystems. The corn, they can be dried, they can be inoculated with mycelium of oyster mushrooms. Watch what happens here. Lots of mushrooms form, but watch what happens here. Too many withdrawals from the carbon bank, the nutritional banks have been overdrawn, and so the mushrooms begin to form, they enlarge, there's on three corn cobs, inoculated with corn spawn, which I inoculated with mycelium and oyster mushrooms. Next day, next day, next day, next day, then you can consume the mushrooms. The corn is good as fodder for cows, chickens, and pigs. It's now proteinaceously rich. Cellulose has been converted into fungal carbohydrates. And then you can take that waste material and you can make myconol. You can create ethanol from the mycelium cellulose that you have as an after consequence. So I see all these as being a stream of secondary and primary products that you can incorporate within the ecosystem that can lead to sustainability. All of us must become engaged with nature. Time is shorter than we think. We have beneath our feet the very fungal solutions that we so desperately need. We just need to wake up and run with mycelium. Thank you very much.